Austerity is not the watchword in Washington these days. I'm David Brancaccio in New York. Republicans and Democrats in the Senate have come up with a collegial way to keep the government funded for about 2 years instead of funding in three-week chunks ahead of government shutdowns. While many will see the spending as important, veterans' hospitals, health insurance for low-income children, helping to fight opioid addiction, austerity this is not. The Senate plan increases federal spending by about $300 billion, and even though the plan's fate in the House is uncertain, markets are reacting today. Let's bring in Diane Swonk, chief economist at the accounting and consulting firm Grant Thornton. Hey, Diane.
Good morning.
So, beyond politics, beyond Democrat and Republican, the bond market is noticing that Washington is fixing to borrow a lot of money moving forward. And you're noticing this as well.
What we're seeing is a lot of money being borrowed to spend a lot of money. In fact, spend it very rapidly. We could see growth nibble up to those 3% levels in the second half of the year very easily because of fiscal stimulus. The problem is, at this stage of the game, there's a price to that. And the price is showing up in the high yields we're seeing in the bond market, and that's in interest rates throughout the economy.
But a lot of people look at what the Senate is proposing to fund here and see a lot of worthy programs.
There's no question that we want these programs. The question is, what can we afford? And that's where we've gotten, is we've spent a long time delaying and deferring very difficult decisions on our priorities. And as a result, we don't have as much fiscal room today, and this is not sustainable in the same way it once might have been, given just the simple math of the aging of the baby boom, the payouts that we need to make for Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Other countries that have gone down this path, the most important issue we've seen is not just the fact that the debt and deficits are rising, but the trajectory going forward. And what the bond market's reacting to today is that our trajectory is one of compounding debt.
But as someone who watches the economy so closely, what I'm hearing is a tension between the here and now and the economy someday.
This is like every Christmas holiday we have, right? We go into debt. In fact, we used a lot of credit cards this holiday season. We just got the report on that. It surged, and then you get a hangover as you have to pay those debts off. At some time, those debts have to be paid.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton in Washington today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
People who have credit card debt in America carry on average more than $10,000 of it. But beyond the average, you can map this. People in Minneapolis and San Francisco have the lowest credit card debt. But then there's Texas. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from Austin.
The study compared the average credit card debt and median income in the 25 largest metro areas in the country. Turns out three of the five cities with the highest credit card debt burden are located in Texas. Matt Schultz helped write the study for creditcards.com. He says Houston and Dallas are in there, but San Antonio residents fared worse.
Their income level is in the bottom five. That's a really difficult combination when you're trying to knock down credit card debt.
Wages are rising nationally, but that growth is slow. Now, there are plenty of jobs available in Texas, and people have been migrating here because housing is relatively cheap. But Cameron Huddleston at GoBankingRates.com says that's changing.
As more and more people are moving into those areas, the real estate prices are going up, and incomes aren't quite as high as you would find on the coast.
She says beyond credit cards, student loans and mortgages contribute to debt, and until wage growth really picks up, many Americans will continue to struggle to pay it off. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
During this flu outbreak, some of us get on airplanes with 3-ounce bottles of hand sanitizer in every pocket. But frequent traveler Mark Orlowski is a stickler during the best of times. He's normally the boss at a nonprofit called the Sustainable Endowments Institute in Boston, but he's always on the road, where he doesn't try to minimize the cost of travel. He tries to maximize his health.
For me, you know, first of all, air quality is key. I really try to avoid staying at any hotels that don't have windows that open. Unfortunately, many new hotels are being built where literally you can't open the window. I really try and avoid that because, you know, many hotels will use air fresheners or chemical cleaners in the rooms. And then when you sort of add the fact that there's no way to get some fresh air or breeze into the room to sort of clear out those smells, I've had times with my girlfriend who has chemical sensitivities, we've had to check in and immediately check back out of the hotel because we just couldn't stay there. She would become sick almost instantly walking into the room.
Also, when you're on the road, you got to watch what you eat. Are you picky about that?
whenever you can, eating sort of as many fresh veggies and some fruit and so forth is really key. If I'm going to be somewhere for more than 24 hours, if I'm going to be somewhere for a few days or staying in a place that maybe has a kitchen or even a kitchenette, I'll often head actually over to the supermarket. And that's another reason why, you know, if I'm staying somewhere for more than a day or two, I often think about or consider, you know, a house type of option, an Airbnb option.
The ironies abound when it comes to not getting sick when you're on the road. When I ate the goat head in Rwanda, true story, I was fine. But when I had the street meat from a cart here in Manhattan, things didn't go quite as well. So I guess, you know, some of these rules probably apply even when you're not on the road.
It's a matter of just trying to, you know, plan ahead where you can. I think a lot of folks also don't think to, you know, email a hotel or email their Airbnb host, for example, ahead of time.
Well, it could be an opportunity for an entrepreneur to let you know what kinds of cleaning products are used in various hotels, how loud the hotels are. Is there a in-wall air conditioner?
That would. You know, another thing, though, surprisingly, right, most major hotel chains and also Airbnb, for that matter, have no actually way to save your preference related to sort of either requesting eco-friendly cleaning products or avoiding chemical cleaners and air fresheners. So that's a kind of a surprising thing. It seems like something that the hotels chains could look at, that Airbnb could look at, and would really make, I think, everyone's life a little bit better.
Mark Orlowski's actual job is founder of a nonprofit called the Sustainable Endowments Institute, but he travels a lot for work and has become quite a pro at this. Mark, always good to talk to you.
Great talking with you, David.
Sure enough, Mark was 16 time zones ahead when we talked there, and I'm in New York. David Brancaccio here with the Marketplace Morning Report. APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.